Hello and welcome to Scheidgeist. I'm your host, Joe, and joining me as ever is my co-host, Dave.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Dave. It is a scorching day outside. The sun is streaming in the windows, but winter has come.
Like
every other podcast out there, we are talking about Game of Thrones. It's the biggest thing.
Oh, I thought we were talking about the seasons. My notes are completely useless. I had some great facts lined up about hibernation and equinox.
Hit me up with one of your hibernation facts, Dave.
Did you know, Joe, that a bear hibernates during the season of winter?
I did know that.
Oh, okay, right.
Did you know that a bear has to form a mucus plug in order to stop its feces from leaking out while it's hibernating?
I did not know that, and I wish that I had never heard that.
You cannot unknow that.
Just the words mucus plug.
Okay, so dragging this swiftly back on topic. That was unintentional.
Spoiler alert. This is your spoiler alert. If you haven't yet, what is it? If you haven't yet seen it, then you better turn. What?
You don't even know the jingle.
Wait.
If you haven't yet seen what we're about to discuss, then you're going to have it spoiled. So please don't make a fuss. Yes, so we're talking about Game of Thrones. Just to be clear to the listeners, we will not be spoiling anything for the current season, season 7. And we, in fact, won't be spoiling a whole lot about the show. We'll be talking in general about the previous 6 seasons. But what we do here on Scheidgeist, and we've never really had a mission statement, but what we do is we talk about the culture and themes around a particular piece of work, so a show or a TV show or a movie, and we discuss why it is the way it is, how it came about, and that's what we're going to do for Game of Thrones. So the big question is, Dave, how did we get here?
Why is everyone talking about this Game of Thrones show? What was the question? Why is Game of Thrones popular?
How did Game of Thrones establish its dominance? How did it get to be like the top spot in terms of the budget, the production value, the viewers? It has consistently gotten high ratings after about the first season. It's been gangbusters since then, once it established its audience. So why is that, Dave?
Well, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because it felt like, we were chatting about this before the show, it's almost 20 years since Lord of the Rings, which is terrifying. 2001 was the first one, wasn't it?
Yeah, so what is that? That's 16 years since it came out, and obviously the pre-production would have started long before that. The Lord of the Rings, at one point, would have been suggested to be unfilmable.
Yeah.
Like, there was a time when those books, you couldn't touch them. There was an animated version, but a live-action version was unthinkable.
And they didn't even finish the animated version, did they? Or they condensed it down. So you're right. I mean, looking at George R.R. Martin's work, you know, back in the 90s, people would have looked at The Lord of the Rings as 3 admittedly massive books that were unfilmable. To try and scale however many books he'd written at that stage would have seemed even more impossible. And TV back then wasn't in a state, you know, The Sopranos had maybe only just come out, but big serialized productions weren't really a thing. I think sort of the quality TV we know today was in its infancy. But I think Lord of the Rings is important because it sort of set the table for proving that fantasy could be done. It turns out it was filmable, and Peter Jackson obviously did an amazing job of it. And that proved that, I guess, that opened the door for more of these very, very popular fantasy properties to come to the front. And we saw, don't forget, we've seen attempts at very successful fantasy properties fail very publicly. A couple that come to mind are the one about the dragons that was written by a 13-year-old Spanish boy whose name
are you thinking of Aragorn.
There's one. There's a sword and sorcery Raymond E. Feist series that was brought to television. that I can't remember the name of. Quality research, Dave. I will. Can we tweet out the name of that later when I remember it?
Okay.
But you get that. They were still that hawkiness involved in it. That sort of Hawk the Slayer sort of vibes.
Yes. And I think previous adaptations of fantasy prior to the early 2000s and Jackson doing such a good job with those, like, previously it was hit and miss and more miss than hit. Like, even fantasy, diehard fantasy fans would be hard-pressed to defend some of the things that were produced. But Lord of the Rings hit, and it hit big, and it had a massive audience. And, you know, the third one won, I forget how many Oscars. It was
13,
one of the...
13, I think. I think it's joint with Titanic, isn't it? Or 11.
Well, I guess that was for the whole series. But yes, for one movie to win 13 Oscars, you have to... You know, the industry has to stand up and take notice. And let's not forget, like, people approached George R.R. Martin to adapt Game of Thrones for probably a decade or more. And he trialed it out. He had various meetings and he had various tests with people. And he wanted it done right. He waited until the right people came along. The story has fallen into folklore now of Weiss and Benioff meeting with George R.R. Martin, and they suggested doing it as a TV series, and George just posed them one question, and the two guys just had a bit of a sidebar with each other. They discussed it and they kind of came back with the answer, and that answer won them the right to do the TV show.
And I think that question was, who is Jon Snow's parents, right?
Yes, who's Jon Snow's mother?
Mother, yeah.
Which, if you've watched season 6, you'll know. And if you haven't, well, maybe you've read the books and you have theories. It hasn't yet been confirmed in the books. But there was a theory that was floating around for years that was confirmed in show last year. So, it just goes to show that George R.R. Martin had a certain type of mind in mind, and that these two guys were uber fans of the work, and it turned out to be the right choice, especially because they brought George R.R. Martin on board as well to help produce the series.
Yes, because crucially he had a background in television writing, so it really was this sort of perfect storm of creativity, like, ready to happen.
Yes, and even the wider culture. Like, in the last 10 years, there's been a mainstream acceptance of nerd culture in a big way. We've seen a resurgence of D&D, which largely was underground for decades, really. It was laying dormant like some sort of sleeping dragon, and now it's out. And there's more and more people playing D&D. It's more and more acceptable.
I would say it was forced underground by having such a very bad reputation. Not a bad reputation, but it was so synonymous with the stereotype of a nerd. For whatever reason, and I don't know, did pop culture create that? But particularly in, you know, the heady days of the 80s and 90s, when movie high schools were filled with jocks wearing their school letter on, you know, with colorful things, the chess club would exist, they'd all have glasses and acne, like that. The pop culture was very comfortable in perpetuating those stereotypes, and I think D&D was just a tool that was an easy go-to tool that was used often for that purpose. So I think growing up I would have experienced a sort of a stigma or a fear of D&D, almost, for fear of just being, like, branded a complete, like, that's like hardcore nerdism. And I was pretty nerdy growing up, as you would remember.
I can vouch for that fact.
So it's something, I've never played D&D, but I think it's something I would enjoy, but never really, you know, had access to it. We did know someone in college who had a lot of the books. Do you remember John?
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, he was into it, okay. Right. Well, let's not forget that there was a campaign in the US that demonized D&D as a form of Satan worship. So
yeah.
there was like a Christian right movement to actually quash D&D for reasons unknown. I mean,
well, because it was the work of Satan, Joe.
Well, when we were teenagers, it was all about heavy metal was the work of Satan, and you know, that's up for debate.
Still is.
I mean, if there's a Satan, he definitely listens to heavy metal, and more power to him. But yeah, so like there's the stigma, rightly or wrongly, and then there's an actual conscious effort to drive D&D underground. You're right. And well, it hasn't succeeded because it's back. It's back in a big way.
Yeah, and I wonder, I feel like community and Dan Harmon had a part to play in that, particularly with his podcast, which is very has been very successful and is very good if anyone hasn't heard it.
Yeah, it's one of the better known podcasts out there. Yes, and his multiple D&D episodes in Community. Let's not forget that the IT Crowd had a D&D episode.
That's right.
As did I'm sure countless other shows. Freaks and Geeks had a D&D episode. So yeah,
and Stranger Things it's an integral part of as well.
Exactly. Yeah. If anything cements its nerd status, then Stranger Things certainly does. In passing, you mentioned The Sopranos, Dave, and I think that is one of the things that unlocked the modern era of prestige television, and HBO in particular ushered in a new way to watch television and a new benchmark for television. And without that, something like Game of Thrones couldn't exist. Without the first of all, the budget, the coffers that that HBO bring to a show like this, and the quality control that they have, as well as let's not forget the ability to create CG worlds that didn't exist 10 years ago. It would not have been convincing enough. Only now are we at the point where you can craft a world that looks as good as it looks. It's expensive and it looks expensive, but it can be done.
Exactly, I agree. And it's hard to imagine Game of Thrones being a success on another network because, as you said, HBO will commit a lot of money to something because they have a certain level of prestige and a premium look that they have to maintain. But also, they tend to give shows way more of a chance to get going than other networks who can be a little more ruthless and will cull a show a lot quicker. Often to the point of where nobody's watching and it still has three or four seasons sometimes of shows. HBO or what was that Martin Scorsese one, Vinyl, that nobody was watching lately and they gave that a second season even though it was a disaster.
That got a second season?
Yeah, I think.
Oh wow! No, I thought it was cancelled after one.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong. But they do tend to try and give things extra. You know, they give them renewals even if they're not a success. Because let's not forget, Game of Thrones wasn't a worldwide phenomenon out of the gates. I remember this. I was living in Australia at the time, and I remember seeing it on a bus and not knowing what the hell it was. But I saw Sean Bean was in it, and he was sitting in a throne, and it looked kind of cool. And I tuned in, watched a few. Nobody was really talking about it for the first season. It's one of those things that grew an audience and a following from word of mouth, I think, particularly when that sort of shock episode 9 or 8 beheading happened.
Yes, yes. I think that is a kind of a landmark moment it's a landmark TV moment, not just for the show, but for television narrative in general too. When Ned Stark is dispatched, then it throws the whole world into turmoil, and it signals to the audience that no one is safe and that anything can happen, which is not something that we're used to. Even usually when a shock death occurs in a series, it's generally not the main dude on the poster.
Exactly.
So, like, this was, and I know HBO aren't responsible for this. This was in the books, and book readers would have known this. But to an audience that had no exposure to it, and I was among them, I watched the first series not having read the book. That was a huge upset, and even the very end of the pilot, which is I must mention is a very, very strong pilot. The moment with Bran in the tower, like that is a, it's a cliffhanger. You have to watch the next episode. It was expertly done.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's another point as to why this show has been so successful, because it it defied expectation consistently, as we've just mentioned, but also it just creates big talking point moments, like it's almost like, where were you when the Red Wedding happened? You know, where were you when Joffrey croaked it? We said we could spoil season 1 to 6, right? So those are sort of big defining moments that we've been trained to expect, but yet still nobody was convinced that Jon Snow was dead.
Over the lifetime of the show, something has developed which is known as plot armor, and you hear people talking about this in forums online. Plot armor is where you are so integral that even if you are killed off, we're pretty sure you're going to be coming back, and in that case, Jon had plot armor.
Yeah, you don't set up mysterious parentage and then just don't pay that off. You just don't.
Yeah, it would be ballsy, but highly frustrating if that persisted as a mystery. If that was the end of him and it was a mystery forever, then that would be annoying.
Yeah, so I would say that that's one of the moments, John's resurrection, that they didn't have the sort of zeitgeist pop culture moment that they expected. I think it was, everyone was just a bit like, yeah, okay. I think it was more of a shock when he died and there was that it ended that season. That was really cool.
Yes, that was the shock. That was the cliffhanger. And I think people had time to digest it. And by the time Game of Thrones was back the following year, I think everyone had pretty much made up their mind.
Yeah, as soon as we thought about it for 5 minutes.
But all that aside, I would say that was a very strong season of the show. And it was the first season that the show was ahead of the books. So for me, it was the most unpredictable and the most edge of your seat viewing, because I had read all the books prior to that.
Gotcha. I still have not read any of the books, by the way.
At this stage, I don't think you're going to get much out of them, because you have the main plot points and all you're missing is hundreds and hundreds of pages of description. So
and time. Do not have
and time.
That
too. You definitely don't have that time. You are. Well, you could read them as bedtime stories, although I wouldn't recommend that.
Well, actually, it's not a bad idea. The baby's not going to understand, are they? Especially if I do sort of a nice sort of a... And then... King Joffrey drank the poison and spurted horrible poisonous venom out of his mouth. His bloodshot eyes stared blankly up to his mother.
Please don't do that. I think one of the other defining characteristics of Game of Thrones, which made it popular, at least for the first season, was that it focused in on the human drama. It was, you know, it's an epic fantasy, but in the beginning, there were very few fantastic elements. It was all about factions and alliances and power and politics and backstabbing. And that made it very interesting and complex. And it allowed for a complexity in character. Like we have become accustomed in the last 10 to 15 years of having anti-heroes, even anti-villains, and having morally ambiguous characters in a way that would not have been on television before. So I think that the conditions were right for a show like Game of Thrones that allowed people to delve a little bit deeper and to look more into it and to enjoy the complexity of it. I think that I'm struggling to think of another show that has the same level of scope and sense of a whole other world with its own political rules.
I'd probably say The Wire is the closest thing I think that I can think of that has this many characters that you can all hold in your head, that are all very well defined, and that all sort of fit together on a, you know, a giant political stage.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And I would say that Game of Thrones has more in common with The Wire than it would with, say, The Lord of the Rings.
Yes, because I think, well, as you said, it's a human drama and the characters are just superbly written. And they're the backbone of all this because the, you know, what the dragons and the Red Witch and the supernatural and the White Walkers and all that is great and it's fun and it's what gives the show, you know, life, and that's the supernatural history and all that's very interesting. That's not a million miles away from anything we've seen in any other fantasy series. But what holds the show up is the characters, because in so many other fantasy properties, the characters are essentially cardboard cutouts. And I would accuse Lord of the Rings a little bit of that, because there's the characters are a little one note in the a few things, you know, a few exceptions, maybe Gandalf and Sam. Maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would certainly say that the Lord of the Rings is a little more simplistic, but I would give Lord of the Rings a pass because it was written in the 1940s.
Yeah.
That, you know, it automatically buys itself a little bit of leeway because it is, in many ways, it's the progenitor of
everything,
of high fantasy.
And also, you know, he did write that for his son or for kids. So maybe I should read that to my child instead.
Well, I would certainly recommend The Hobbit. That would be a good one.
For sure.
But let's not forget that we're talking about complexity here. Both J.R.R. Tolkien and George R.R. Martin, both of them put together languages, in Tolkien's case, an entire language with a whole history for the book, for the series of The Lord of the Rings. So to say that it's simplistic is to really do a disservice to the linguistic effort that went into it. I think while a fraction of that effort went into the Dothraki language in Game of Thrones, linguists were hired in order to flesh that out. So what was a very basic framework has now been fleshed out into a full, convincing-sounding language.
Well, just to, I wasn't saying that the Lord of the Rings is simplistic, because, that, as you say, that would be incredibly unfair. He created an entire world of language, as you said, and spawned an entire genre. But I think just on a character level, take Gimli. He's an angry dwarf. You know, what's his character arc? Legolas is cool with a bow. And
sure,
he's very serene. Do you know what I mean? And it's like Merry and Pippin are comic relief characters. They're a little bit archetypal. Whereas with Game of Thrones, there's a vast amount of characters, and a few of them are a little archetypal. I think Jon Snow could be called that, but even he has had, he's been fleshed out incredibly with Ygritte and just his experiences at the Wall, and you see him grow, and I think he has grown incredibly. Just every one of the characters in Game of Thrones feel like real people, which I don't think the Lord of the Rings ever did achieve. And I didn't mean for this to become some sort of direct comparison of the two, but I think it is it is interesting, and I think that is part of the success of this show, because if you take away the tits and dragons, as Ian McShane said, this show would work if you took all these characters and put them in a modern setting. I think it would still be fascinating.
True. And it's actually something we haven't mentioned, is the copious amount of sex, violence, and sexual violence that's in Game of Thrones, which is, like it or lump it, it is a selling point. I mean, there were a number of people that I work with. They have since stopped, but they used to refer to Game of Thrones as boobies and swords. That was their name for the show.
Fair enough.
So, like, even casual watchers were drawn in by those, we'll call them salacious elements, but those are things that are largely gone from the show now. The show has changed a lot in its over the last 6-7 years.
Do you feel like that's partly due to some criticism that it's had for that?
Possibly. I would say that it was a calculated attempt by HBO to grow an audience, and that they would have reduced it. It would have tailed off naturally anyway. But yeah, the backlash from the community, from the audience, and from the wider media, that has had an effect. But I would say that had that not happened, it would have tailed off anyway, because there's less and less of an excuse for it. There's more story to cover, and the stories have become more condensed.
And Littlefinger left his brothel. He never owned a brewery, as far as I know.
His brothelry. Although, do you know, with all that said, there was an awful lot of brothel business in season 5, and the walk of shame in season 5. You know, there's still no shortage of nudity. It's just that
it's not in a sexual context anymore.
True, and it's not quite so gratuitous.
No, and I think anyone who gets their kicks out of that shame scene needs to have their head looked at.
Bear in mind as well that Game of Thrones coined the term sex position. A piece of expository dialogue would occur while people were having sex on screen. Just, you know,
just in the background.
Here's to keep you interested, and here's a bit of plot. And pay attention to one or the other. You can't pay attention to both.
Well, I would say a slight tangent. Westworld is particularly guilty of that exact thing.
Yes, that's true. But it's one of the key selling points about Westworld is wish fulfillment, and particularly taboo wish fulfillment.
It's what the visitors are doing, or whatever they were called, the guests. It's what they would naturally be doing, shagging robots.
I have to say, if anyone wants more of that, we did a whole episode on Westworld previously, so if you can find that through our archives on Shitegeist Pod.
Yes, with our partners.
Yes, it doesn't excuse it, but it is integral to the plot.
Yeah.
So I think we've explored why Game of Thrones is the cultural phenomenon that it is. It just seems like the right time for a show of this scale and dealing with this subject matter. But as well as the factors leading up to it, there are a lot of real life parallels that can be seen in Game of Thrones. I think it's worth exploring some of those. We'll start with political disenfranchisement. I think that the political climate in the real world isn't a million miles from that of Game of Thrones. It seems like whoever's in power, it's never good for the common man or for the peasants. No one really profits from it.
Yeah, that's true. And they tend to be tyrants for the most part. And good people, things don't tend to work out for good people in politics, I would say. In reality and Game of Thrones?
Yeah, well, I would say that the political machinations in Game of Thrones can certainly be seen elsewhere. I think that there are a lot of people making allies and protecting their arses in the real world as well.
So do you think we would be better or worse with Cersei instead of Trump?
Oh, that's very difficult. You see, it's you're trying to pick the lesser of two evils there. They're certainly two evils.
I think Daenerys would be good. I'd take her as president of the USA.
Okay. Well, that is interesting. That brings up another topic, which is that that dragons can stand in as a parable for nuclear arms. So in the world of Game of Thrones, whoever controls and holds the dragons, those are like the ultimate doomsday device. Whoever controls them controls the geopolitical climate.
Are you saying that Daenerys Targaryen is like Kim Jong-il in North Korea? She's in a foreign part of the world. She may or may not have dragons.
We cannot confirm it.
She's definitely a threat to King's Landing, and they're aware of it. She's been testing her dragons off the coast of
This is tenuous at best.
I'm trying so hard.
I think the key difference is that Daenerys is a superpower, whereas Kim Jong-un, maybe not so much.
But yeah, that's interesting. So if everyone had dragons in Game of Thrones, then there would be peace, according to that's how pro-nuclear people see it, right?
I don't think anyone's pro-nuclear, but I think people say, well, if one faction has the dragons, then we should all have dragons to even the playing field.
Yeah, that's like the only solution to gun control is more guns, isn't it?
Yes, which is a fallacious argument. But yeah, that's basically the same thing. You'll notice that in some scenes in Game of Thrones, there are merchants and powerful people trying to either buy or steal at various points the eggs and the dragons from Daenerys. And I think that parallels real life. If a country cannot become a nuclear power themselves, they will attempt to steal or purchase nuclear capability from a superpower. So I think that there is some merit in that comparison. Also, on the battlefield, there is nothing to compare with dragons. We haven't really seen them in action so far, but there doesn't seem to be any defense against them.
So what are their real life equivalent of the giants? Like a rocket launcher?
The giants could be tanks.
Oh yeah, tanks. That's good. Except if a tank explodes, you don't weep uncontrollably. Poor 1-1!
Yeah, it's amazing how much they made us feel for 1-1 in like under one season.
I know. He was just so lovable. I think, well, we got that he was just amazing in the battle of Snowy White Walker invaded. What was it called?
Are you talking about Hardhome?
Hardhome, that was it.
And subsequently the Battle of the Bastards, he played a key role. Yeah, I just think people project onto strong, cuddly things.
Even though the practicalities of cuddling him would be quite difficult.
Problematic at best, I would say. Let's not forget as well the real life inspiration for Game of Thrones, which is the War of the Roses, which is something that I'm not terribly au fait with. I'm not a history buff by any stretch of the imagination, but there was a real life political figure, Edward of Lancaster, who came to power as a young boy, and was reported to be obsessed with killing people in imaginative ways, and pretty much the real life King Joffrey.
Sounds like a dick.
Yeah. There's also,
I don't know anything about these people.
There's a George Plantagenet who stands in for Theon Greyjoy. He was the first Duke of Clarence, and much like Greyjoy, he was the ward of a powerful house, fought for them, and then eventually turned. So there are real life similarities. There's a real life parallel for Jaime Lannister. There is a political figure called Gottfried von Berlichingen.
Do you say that again, Joel, please?
Berlichingen.
One more time.
No. But he's famous.
Berlichingen.
He's famous for having his hand blown off by a cannon and getting an iron replacement hand. So, it's kind of an interesting one.
I think Jamie's character would have been far less impactful if his name was Gottfried von Berlichingen.
I'm sure if you lived in that time, in that part of the world, it might have made more sense. It might have been easier to pronounce, but sadly, I don't. Actually, no, gladly, I don't. I'm quite glad I don't live then.
The name would have struck fear into the hearts of millions. Gottfried von Bergen.
Yeah. Another thing that Game of Thrones touches on is faith. And there are competing religious ideologies. There are the old gods that the people in the north and the people north of the wall worship, and there are there's the many faced god, and there are the seven, and then there's the
one true god.
The Lord of Light is the other faction. So they explore the differences between different religious ideologies, and they even have the faith militant, who are religious zealots who they seem to use violence as a means of preaching their message.
Yeah, that's an easy one to compare to modern life, unfortunately.
Yeah, there are some real life parallels there. Also, more importantly, the driving force behind the entirety of Game of Thrones is analogous to climate change. They said at the very start, winter is coming, and there have been deniers from the start, and there have been believers.
Winter deniers. Winter is not coming. Winter is a myth. Do not believe the scientists.
Much like the real world, the change in climate will manifest and is manifesting in both real life and in the show.
And in the show and in real life, it will bring with it utter destruction.
Slightly morbid, but there you go.
Yeah, you're making me sad, Joe. For the record, I'm not a climate change denier. I realise it might have sounded like that a second ago.
Oh, no, no, no. It was clear that you were making a joke.
I just wanted to be clear. It's happening, people.
So, I guess that's why Game of Thrones has dominated for the last number of years. And that's kind of why it resonates with people nowadays. This is the world we live in, almost.
How do you think that this is going to affect the future of television when it ends? Or, you know, what's going to fill this void when Game of Thrones has ended?
There's always a real sense of what now when you finish a big series like this. And we're what, 2 years off finishing it now at this point?
Yeah.
We have 7 episodes this year, and there's a further 6. So it's 1 or 2 years until the next series, and that's a long time to wait. And it's when it is over, there'll be a huge sense of, oh well, what now? What do we look forward to?
And the answer is Love Island, which I am addicted to.
I haven't seen any of it.
I mean, it's complete trash, but I absolutely love it.
It's enjoyable trash. That's always good.
Yeah.
It's not an easy question. I mean, will HBO be able to resist the temptation of doing a spin-off or a prequel?
I don't think so. I think it's inevitable, right? Like, there's no way they're letting go of this giant cash cow.
Well, I suppose they have to weigh it up. You know, there have been attempts like Fear the Walking Dead, which doesn't seem to have worked at all.
No, did you watch that?
No, nobody did.
Oh, yeah, me neither. Better Call Saul was pretty good, though. Is pretty good.
It was pretty good. I don't think it's had the impact that Breaking Bad has had, but
no,
I quite
not.
Enjoy it. So, if they were to make a prequel, what would you like to see in that, Dave? Where would you like to? What stories would you like it to explore?
I would like them to go way, way, way back, in like 1,000 years before now. I do not want them to show us the story, you know, the adventures of young Ned Stark. I don't want to see the Mad King. I don't want to see anything that we already know about, because I'm sick of prequels. So sick of prequels, and Star Wars is entrenched in this trap right now. With these spin-off movies, and I do not want to see that. Give us fresh stories in the same universe. Go way into the past or way into the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if you're going to do this, it would be tempting to tell the story of Robert's Rebellion, but way more worthwhile to go way back into like old Valyria and the first Targaryens would be a good place to start.
That I would like to see.
There is a podcast that touched on that. It was called this is a bit of a tangent, but it was it's called Shadow of the Dragon, and it's a parody of hardcore history, but it's the history of Game of Thrones. So anyone who's interested in that story should check that out. It is fascinating.
Oh my god, that must take so much time to put together.
Yeah, it really must. Yeah, so I think that would be satisfying. Although, I would rather see it end after 7 seasons. I think 7 is enough for any show. Anything more than that is milking it.
I agree. Well, they're doing that, aren't they? There's only, they've committed to only two more, right?
Yeah. But that begs the question: what will the show after this be?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to be Westworld.
No, because they are taking 18 months to make the next series. So I think by the time Westworld eventually comes back, people will have stopped caring.
Agreed. And I think I'm definitely going back for more Westworld, and I think it is going to be a big show for them, but it's not going to hit these kind of numbers or this kind of scale. I don't know. It's just too hard to predict, isn't it?
Let's look at this. This was based on a successful series of books. Is there any other successful series of books which could be adapted like this? I mean, is there a market for a Robert Jordan Wheel of Time series?
Oh, I used to love those books. Although I couldn't finish them. I only got to like 6 or 7, and there was like 13 of those.
Yeah, I never read them. They seemed like a Herculean task to get through. Weren't they continued after the death of the author? I think someone else picked up the mantle and finished them off.
His son, I think, yeah. But he'd written extensive notes.
It's worth mentioning that there's every chance that will happen with Game of Thrones also. George R.R. Martin is no spring chicken.
And is in no rush.
Well, he's not producing the books at the rate that he had promised. So there's every chance that someone else will have to pick it up.
But at least the story will be finished. You know, he's clearly sketched it out with Weiss and Benioff.
Yes, absolutely. No, somebody out there knows the end of the story. And they are bringing it to fruition. So that is something. At least we'll be guaranteed an ending. And an ending that George R.R. Martin himself has ratified, if not created. Yeah, I think that's it for Game of Thrones. You'll notice that we didn't delve too deeply into recaps or into the series. If you want that, there are, at a conservative estimate, there are a billion Game of Thrones podcasts that you can listen to. So if you want to do that, go and enjoy it. I would recommend, A Cast of Kings is a good one. A few out there. There are a few to choose from. I'm just looking forward to the rest of the series, and I hope it lives up to the promise of the series so far.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the first episode was good, so fingers crossed. I'm in. I'm there.
We should mention, Dave, you're doing a recap yourself, episode by episode, on the Cinema Isle, aren't you?
I am one of those thousands of podcasts that has taken this singular task upon themselves. myself and Kathy, because we're having a baby, we're trying to anticipate not being able to get to the cinema as much. So we thought this was a perfect one to just sit in the couch in.
Yeah, so if you're interested in checking that out, it's The Cinemile is the name of the podcast, and you can catch it on Twitter at The Cinemile, correct?
That's it. And you can catch us here at ShiteGeistPod, or you can email us at shitegeistpod@gmail.com.
Well said, Dave. That's it. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Joe. See you soon.